Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Home Fires by Luann Rice, narrated by Nancy Peterson. Chapter 1. The fire started in the tangled old wires behind the bathroom heater. At first there was no flame, only a core of intense heat. The wires frayed insulation, gray weave, with the texture of a man's jacket, began to smolder. One spark popped, then another. The orange line crackled to the panel board, causing a momentary blink of the house's microwave, stereo, television, and alarm clocks. In that instant, the portable phone beside Ann Davis's bed clicked, resetting itself. Usually, the sound would awaken her, but tonight it barely penetrated her deep sleep. She had been traveling all day. It had been months since she had slept well. She half turned toward the bedside table, but she was engulfed in a sweet dream that would not release her. Tendrils of blue smoke wisped through the wallboards three rooms away. They dissipated like ghosts into the thin winter air. Flames licked the wall from behind, trying to follow the smoke. They raced in all directions, searching for cracks. One line of fire spawned another, and another, all crazy to escape. They filled the space like agitated spectators in an arena crammed beyond its capacity. They sped down the wires, and that was all it took. When the electrical system exploded, the flames burst through the wall in one thunderous blast. The house was on fire. It was another Karen dream that enveloped Anne as she slept. A dream of hazy images, clear bliss. Karen in her arms, at the beach, with Matt nearby. The sun's heat sensual and intense. Anne's nose pressed against Karen's skin, the spot where her neck and shoulder met, smelling of summer. Baby sweat, copper tone SPF 40, salt water, chocolate from a Good Humor bar. Karen's weight on Anne's lap, and the sound of waves lapping the shore. A clack. Sounds from the outside world. Anne shifted, her face burrowing into the pillow, anything to preserve the dream. The family on summer vacation. Matt, Karen, and Anne together on a beach blanket. The hot summer day. She had it back, that feeling of joy and closeness. It was perfect, and so very real. She could touch Matt's leg, lick salt grains from the nape of Karen's neck. All her senses were awake. Contentment throbbed through her body like lifeblood. Then the house exploded. Anne jumped out of bed. For a second, she didn't know where she was. She started for Karen's bedroom just yards away, then realized she wasn't in their New York apartment. She had come to the island, to her family home. The place where she'd grown up. Smoke drifted in from the hall under the closed bedroom door. Shivering in the dark, Anne touched the door with her hand. It felt scorching hot. Grabbing a bureau scarf, she wrapped it around the brass knob and pushed. Fire roared inward, burning her hand as she slammed the door. She ran to the window and saw the snow glistening orange a long drop below. Her room was on the second floor, and the land sloped steeply away. In the distance, coming from town, she heard a siren. She returned to the door and touched the knob, as if to check that it hadn't somehow incredibly cooled down. Then, with no other choice, she turned back to the window. "Karen," she said, choking with smoke and panic. There was no time to tie bedsheets together, no time to wait for the island volunteer fire department. She opened the window and looked down. Height, even this 20-foot height, terrified her. She gulped air, but the smoke was catching up with her. She could jump out the window, she thought, then re-enter the house by the porch door. Climbing over the sill in her white nightgown, she let herself hang against the side of the house. It took forever to summon the power it took to let go. "Don't think about it," she told herself. "You have to do this. Jump. Jump." Finally, her fingers obeyed. With bare feet, she kicked off. Her eyes were closed. She tried to forget she was falling. A snow-capped yew brush broke her landing, and she rolled a few yards down the hill before she could stop herself. Flames had broken through the bathroom roof, and the west upstairs windows glowed. Sirens screamed down Salt Whistle Road. Before Anne reached the porch, she heard men shouting, spools creaking as the hoses were unwound. Suddenly, her mind was clear, and a superhuman burst of will propelled her across the yard, across the porch floor. "Stop! Don't go in there!" someone called. Anne glanced over her shoulder at the fire truck and saw a big man running toward her. He towered over everyone, a giant in black rubber coat, Star Wars mask, and yellow fireman's hat. Anne rattled the door. Locked. She let out a cry of panic and frustration. From a nest of dry brown leaves, she grabbed a smooth rock painted with the dark spars of a sailing ship by Anne herself at age 7, and used by the family ever since as a doorstop. Smashing it through a pane of glass, she reached inside to find the deadbolt. "Please, no," the man shouted, running closer. Anne's hand shaking, she glanced back again. He had flipped the mask up, and Anne was shocked to see that his left cheek was melted, like wax on a candlestick. His eyes had battle in them, urgency and alarm. If he wanted to stop her, he was Anne's enemy. Moaning with panic, she groped for the deadbolt. Finding it, she gave it a turn. And then she was inside. Thomas X. Devlin of the Island Volunteer Fire Department stood outside the old house on Salt Whistle Road, watching black smoke seep through the attic vents. Flames lit the west windows on the second floor. He felt a shiver go down his spine, the way it always did at a fire ground. His skin grafts felt stiff, and he flexed his hands a few times, getting ready to work. Car and truckloads of volunteers were streaming around the marsh, sounding a cacophony of air horns and sirens, a parade of pulsating blue strobe lights. Martin Cole lined up the cherry picker, and Thomas Devlin was reaching for the roof saw when he spied the woman. With her black hair and white nightgown, she was nearly invisible against the snow and night sky. She staggered up the hill, seeming to sway for an instant, before charging onto the porch with the force of a locomotive and the grace of an apparition. Thomas Devlin shouted to her. She glanced over her shoulder, and he bounded off the truck. She was trying the door, searching the porch for something. She was on a rescue mission. He saw it in her eyes. He crossed the yard in 4 strides, his arms out to catch her before she entered the burning house. He called up again, but a patch of ice tripped him up. He stumbled, just missed falling, heard the glass break. When he looked up, she had disappeared into the smoke. Where was she heading? Upstairs? To a bedroom for a sleeping husband? Child? He'd seen the mad look in her eyes during the split second she'd glanced back. The woman had appeared small, desperate, and breathless. She wouldn't have much time before the smoke got to her. Thomas Devlin felt for his regulator, pulled down his face mask, and entered the house. No newcomer to fire, he had been a paid firefighter in Boston before coming to the island 10 years ago. But every fire was new. Every fire could mean death. Blue and red strobe lights bounced through the smoke until he was 3 feet inside, and then everything was black. He crawled into the room, his breath through the air mask sounding artificial, like an iron lung. he envisioned the house's floor plan. He had been in plenty like it. It was the design of choice for working-class island families during the 30s, a tinderbox built to withstand hurricanes. He fixed on the stairs, where he figured she was heading. Moving toward the fire, he heard something drop to the floor off to his left. He changed directions. Feeling his way along the wall, he touched her body before he saw her. He swooped her off the floor and cradled her in his arms. Through his thick rubber coat, he felt her chest rise and fall. Outside, he held her close to protect her from the bitter cold. Away from the smoke, he could see she was clutching a diaper bag. By the way she lay limp in his arms, he knew she was unconscious. Firefighters and police band groupies milled around. Sarah Tisdale came running with blankets and a tank of O2. "Anyone else inside?" Brian Grisky shouted. "She went back after something," Thomas Devlin said. He laid her on one blanket and covered her with another while Sarah placed the oxygen mask over her face. Gently, he pried the bag from her hands, intending to look for clues. At the sight of the stuffed toy, the tiny dresses and sweater, his heart began to race. Almost instantly, she came to. She struggled to rise, then fell back. Her hand reached for the bag. "There's a child inside the house?" he asked, shaking the woman's shoulder. "Where? Tell me where." The woman blinked, trying to swallow. She pushed the oxygen mask away. "The house is empty," she croaked.
"It's empty," Brian called out. "All clear."
Soot coated the woman's pale face, making it nearly as dark as her hair. The smoke had swollen her eyes nearly shut. But even though she was half frozen, half asphyxiated, Thomas Devlin could see that she was lovely. She had a small body, but only a heart of steel could have made her enter that burning house.
"Where's the child?" he asked, watching her fumble through the soiled diaper bag.
She suddenly regained the air of panic he had seen about her when he had thought she was on a mission of rescue. Her eyes darted back and forth, from one side of the bag to the other. She bit her lower lip. And then she had it, the moment of relief. She threw her head back, then raised it again to look. Her hand closed around something, withdrawing it from the bag. A crumpled sheet of manila paper, one side covered with crayon marks. Tears squeezed out of the corners of her eyes.
"The child?"
he asked again, more softly.
"There is no child,"
the woman answered. And she turned her head away. Chapter 2.
"I mean, my God," Gabrielle said, bracing herself against the kitchen counter. She had made Anne a plate of sliced apples and cheese, but she couldn't seem to deliver it to the table. Every time she thought of the fire, the danger Anne had put herself in, she'd feel the most dizzying combination of relief and fury.
"Everything is fine," Anne said.
"Everything is not fine," Gabrielle said, serving the plate with a forceful clatter. "What were you thinking, running back into a burning house?"
"I had to get something."
"Something? You nearly died going in after a thing. A thing."
Anne just sat there, staring. Gabrielle felt so helpless, completely unable to connect with her younger sister. Growing up, they had kept no secrets from each other. Adulthood, and the dramatically different turns their lives had taken, had changed that somewhat. But Gabrielle would have said they were still close. Until Karen's death. Because now, no matter how much Gabrielle wanted to help, no matter how badly she wanted to ease her pain and protect her, she couldn't imagine exactly how it must have felt for Anne to see her 4-year-old daughter die.
"I wish you would let us know you were coming to the island," Gabrielle said, instead of what she really wanted to say. "I didn't know myself until yesterday morning. A spur-of-the-moment thing? Gabrielle asked, hating the small talk.
Yes. Most people want to get off the island in February, not come to it.
But then again, you're not most people.
No, Anne said blankly. I'm not.
Great, Gabrielle thought. She'd been trying to pry a smile out of Anne, alluding to what she teasingly called Anne's jet-set life. But all conversational gambits led back to Karen. In the 7 months since Karen died, Gabrielle had lost the ability to talk to her own sister. It was like talking to a shell. Like one of the channeled whelk shells Gabrielle collected on her daily walks on the beach. Empty, cold, self-contained and silent. Talk into one and your words would echo right back to you.
I'd been thinking for some time about coming out, Anne said slowly. To stay for a while.
How long is a while?
Until, I don't know. I just know I can't stay in New York anymore.
Gabrielle wasn't sure whether Anne intended this as an opening, but she dropped the towel she had been folding and took the chair beside Anne's.
It must be so hard for you, she said, holding Anne's hand.
Anne squeezed back, hard enough to startle Gabrielle. Tears were running down her cheeks, but even now she wouldn't speak.
I don't know how you stayed this long, Gabrielle said, completing the sentence in her mind.
In the apartment where Karen died.
I can't stand being in the same city as Matt, Anne said.
I was thinking more of, Gabrielle began. But Anne wouldn't allow her close to the subject of Karen.
I still love him, you know? It's ridiculous. But I do.
I'd like to get my hands on him, Gabrielle said. Matt had left immediately after the funeral. He had been planning to move out anyway, apparently. Karen's death was just his excuse.
Gabrielle,
Anne said, giving the name an inflection at once stern and plaintive.
Anne, Gabrielle said, finally exploding. Is there anything I can talk to you about? We can't talk about Matt. You won't let me near Karen. I loved her too, you know.
Everything's lost, Anne said, her voice barely a whisper. Her eyes focused on the untouched plate of fruit and cheeses. Not everything, Gabrielle said emphatically. You can't think like that. Anne didn't reply. Frustration, the desire for closeness, had pushed Gabrielle over the edge. And now Anne had retreated even more. Gabrielle needed to be in control of her relationships, and when she wasn't, it drove her crazy. Her mind would start to sizzle. Her body must have produced some sort of chemical because she could actually taste frustration in the back of her throat. Absently, Gabrielle plucked some lint off the sleeve of Anne's beige sweater. Cashmere, she thought, hating herself for noticing. Despising the fact that envy was creeping in. Gabrielle, who had adored Anne since the moment their parents had brought her home from the hospital, couldn't stand the way she felt. But here she was, married to her perpetually debt-ridden high school sweetheart and living on the same godforsaken island she had grown up praying would sink into the sea, while Anne was living the good life. Anne and Matt, so gorgeous and in love, so rich. Every year his business just got better, necessitating more and more exotic business trips. Always with Anne along, of course. Every postcard of the Taj Mahal, the northern beaches of Thailand, the Baie des Anges, another trigger for Gabrielle's envy. And who would have thought that Anne's silly childhood hobby would bring her fame and an income all her own? That Anne could have become well known for the delicate little collages she fashioned of images cut from postage stamps. Her quirky collages hung in galleries in New York and Tokyo, and the unique pieces had recently been used on the covers of a line of classical music CDs. The great irony being that, as a child, Gabrielle had been the better artist, had won prizes for her work all through childhood and college,
even in contests against Anne. Now, gazing down at her sister who had lost everything, Gabrielle felt poisoned with resentment and the guilt it brought. But life on the island was hard, especially in the winter when the construction business would stop dead. She would see Steve drinking beer and watching TV, and instead of screaming at him to get his feet off the goddamn table and put his butt out of the easy chair and help her do the dishes, she would stand at the sink wishing Anne's galleries would dump her. Gabrielle would imagine her own teenage daughter, Maggie, making high honors and getting into Harvard while secretly hoping that Karen, who'd been enrolled at some fancy New York kindergarten, would grow up into a troublemaker and a dropout. Thinking of the bad luck she had imagined for Karen, Gabrielle had to turn her face away from Anne. Karen had died a month before she would have entered kindergarten. "Can you smell the smoke?" Anne asked, raising her wrist to her nose. "One night in the hospital and two showers, and I can still smell it and taste it. The poor house. I burned down our childhood home." "Steve says the damage isn't too bad, considering. Three rooms upstairs are ruined, and the roof. And the wiring was a disaster waiting to happen. He'll fix it." "It's nice to have a builder in the family," Anne said, smiling for the first time since coming to Gabrielle's house. "Yes, well, the insurance check will be a welcome, welcome sight." "Your business must be slow this time of year." "That's putting it mildly, although we'll get a boost at Valentine's Day." The seduction table, her catering business. Gabrielle was aiming for the love market, and although it went over big with the summertime yachties, the year-round islanders were too practical and unromantic to buy it. The telephone rang. Gabrielle saw Anne close her eyes wearily, probably hoping that the call would bring a reprieve from Gabrielle's ministrations. "Hello," Gabrielle said, all business, planning to cut short whoever was calling and get back to Anne. "Gabrielle, hi. It's Thomas Devlin. May I speak with your sister, please?" "Just a second," Gabrielle said, covering the mouthpiece with her hand and jostling Anne. "It's for you." "Who?" Anne asked, hope shimmering behind the frown in her eyes. She probably thought it was Matt. "Thomas Devlin, the fireman who went in after you." Anne's frown deepened, and she waved the call away. "Tell him I'm asleep." Gabrielle hesitated, wishing Anne would make the simple gesture of thanking the man for saving her life. Wouldn't that be the healthy, life-affirming, getting-back-to-normal thing to do? "Please," Anne said, sensing that Gabrielle was about to push. "I don't feel like talking. I'll send him a note later." "I'm sorry, Thomas," Gabrielle said directly into the receiver, turning her back on Anne. "She seems to be asleep, but I'll tell her you called."
"How's she doing?" he asked.
"She's going to be just fine," Gabrielle said, without a trace of conviction in her voice. Thomas Devlin hung up the phone in his workshop and tried to put Anne Davis out of his mind and get back to work. Cuckoo clocks, grandfather clocks, gold watches, Swiss chimes, inner works without faces covered every inch of wall space and every available tabletop. He had inherited his father's tools and some of his knowledge, but he considered clockmaking a hobby, not a trade. Every time he entered a burning building, he'd prove it to himself over again. He was a firefighter through and through. The fact amazed him. After the bad fire in Boston so many years ago, the one that had burned off half his face and all of his joy, a betting man would have said that Thomas Devlin was finished as a fireman. Thomas had believed it himself. He'd taken refuge on the island, set himself up as a clockmaker, and one day astounded himself by joining the volunteer fire department. Most of the calls they got were routine: grease fires at the fish house, kids playing with matches behind the school, barbecues run amok. Then there were calls like the one they'd had this week: the house on Saltwhistle Road. he kept seeing the woman. His first sight of her when she was standing in the snow was vivid in his mind. The fierce beauty in her dark eyes, her clenched fists and the tension in her shoulders, her nightgown molded to her body by the wind. He remembered how his heart had pounded when he saw her enter the house. Even more when he followed her in and realized how hard it would be to find her in the smoke. She had been moving with hurricane force, full of some life or death purpose, so it had seemed doubly shocking to find her crumpled on the floor. She had seemed somehow invincible, a woman of superhuman strength. He had lifted her with so little effort. She was light as a feather. Her body had been supple in his arms, and cold from her standing barefoot in the snow. Now working on Emma Harwood's mental clock, Thomas Devlin pushed the glasses up his nose. The left earpiece rubbed on his scars, making them itch. The wind howled outside, but all he could hear was the clock. Strange that someone who had chosen to work on clocks half the day couldn't stand the sound of ticking. It made him feel trapped. 6'4", and using doll-sized tools. Hot and uneasy, he pushed back his chair, knocking over a cigar box full of springs. "Damn it," he said, watching the minuscule springs roll under the desk, into floor cracks, behind the bookcase. He just stood there scratching his scar. His concentration was useless. Time for a ride. Anything for some open air. Maybe take a drive out to the dunes and watch the waves build. The wind had shifted east, and some good breakers should be rolling in. Stop thinking about the mystery woman who had come to the island. She had upset his balance in a way he couldn't quite define, and that made him feel nervous and ornery. He threw on his parka and grabbed the truck keys. Just as he stepped outside, damned if Peggy Lawson wasn't pulling down the driveway. She climbed out of her red neon, holding Mac's gold watch at him, like a hypnotist on the stage in a New Bedford dive. "Lose us 10 minutes every other day," Peggy said, her voice raspy from cigarettes. "I'll give it a look," Thomas said. "Sure you have time? I hear you're pretty busy being a hero these days." "Oh, the salt whistle fire?" he asked casually, recalling that Hugh Lawson, Peggy and Mac's nephew, had been at the scene. "I hear you saved the lady of the house," Peggy said, in a way that made it clear she had a story to tell. "Ann Davis, do you know her?" "Of course. She's an island girl, born and bred, just like me. Though she certainly tried to put it behind her. Know what I mean?" Thomas Devlin knew that nothing but sorrow could come from listening to rumors. So he started to edge toward his truck. But Peggy's car was blocking him. "I went to school with her sister, Gabrielle. You know Gabby Vincent, don't you? Steve's wife?" "Sure," Thomas said, amazed all over again. He couldn't quite picture it. The woman he had rescued being related to Gabrielle. Gabrielle had big bones, big red hair, a big Ford van, and a laugh he swore echoed from here to Nantucket. Nothing seemed to faze her. Anne was small. Entering the house, she had moved like a linebacker. But later, when Thomas had laid her down and she opened her eyes, Thomas could see that something inside had broken. That whatever had hurt her was worse than the fire. "She was a wild one, Anne was, and trouble has certainly followed her. Money can't always buy happiness." "No, well, she married it, and a lot of good it did her."
"She's married?"
"Separated, divorced, something like that. He walked out." Thomas didn't want to hear any more. The wind stung his ears, and he could practically see the waves, mountains of green water trailing foamy crests behind. He would park by the clay cliffs and walk to the lighthouse, clear his head. Tonight, he'd eat leftover beef stew and write a letter to his son Ned away at boarding school. "Have a quiet night,"
Sample complete. Ready to continue?